Okay, I would like to call the meeting to order at 6:02 p.m. Call for a moment of silence, please. We stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic which stands one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Just a bit of housekeeping. If anyone has any electronic devices, we would appreciate it if you would turn them off during the meeting as it affects our sound system. Roll call, please.
Charlie Hawkins.
Here.
Dennis Olison.
Here.
Bonnie Onion.
Here.
Harry Robinson.
Here.
And Steve Lawrenson.
Here.
Okay.
Mary Lou Stewart and Paul Greeno both requested to be excused tonight.
I would accept a motion for Paul Greeno to miss the meeting.
So moved.
Second.
Any? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. I'll accept the motion for Mary Lou Stewart.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion's carried 5-0. Next item on our agenda is audience participation. If anyone would like to come forward and speak to the council, you're welcome to do so. Kelly Sutter would like to come forward. If you would come forward, be kind enough to please state your name and address for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Kelly Sutter, and I live in Blaine. So, I would just like to thank the council and the members of Blaine Community Government. I heard a few people complaining about when we decided to put in a pirate ship down at Marine Park. Oh, why are we spending that money? Blah, blah, blah. And I just want you to know I went down in January on a freezing cold but sunny day. The wind was howling, and I counted 15 families down there enjoying the park with their kids. And every time I've gone down there, there are people enjoying the park. So I just want to thank the council for their vision and foresight in supporting that decision for the Parks Board and making Blaine an awesome place to live. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. We really appreciate your comments. Okay, next item on the agenda is written communication. Do we have any, Sherry?
We do. We had a letter dated February 9th from Matthew Lang regarding the stop signs and the issuance of traffic tickets at the Pacific Highway Port of Entry. Two emails from Leslie Smith regarding the Soshan Girls School. An email, actually both from Debbie Harger and Carol Solomon, regarding the grand opening of the Blaine Pavilion on Thursday, February 18th at 5:30 p.m.
Okay, thank you. Next is our consent agenda. And we have, pardon. Yes.
Can you get a feedback from Mike on the letter?
Yeah, I was going to ask if we have responded to that letter.
You know, I don't know yet. I was expecting them to be here
today. Okay. Yeah, it seems to, from the letter, it seems to be a reasonable request. And I think we should have the police chief respond to how he's going to handle that.
So the last time we spoke about it, his comment was that that stop sign was in the jurisdiction of the federal government, because it's within their bounds of the port of entry.
Right.
We could suggest that they change that sign, but that sign was installed at their request.
Okay.
The Border Patrol request. So we could ask for that to be changed and forward that along. I don't think Public Works has the authority to change signs on federal property.
Yeah.
But we can follow up with that.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's what he's been tasked to follow up with.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we have the consent agenda, approval of bills in the amount of $130,822.91, and approval of the council minutes for February the 8th, 2016. I would entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda.
I had one question about the Maple Leaf Auto Body. Maple Leaf Auto Body, $6,000.
Where is that?
It's on the bills, second page, down towards the bottom. Two checks for $3,000.
Raven, are those yours, or do those belong to the police department?
Well, that might be the police department.
That's what we were just speculating. If new police vehicles being outfitted might be that, because it's neither of ours.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Charlie, we can make a note, and we'll follow up with that for you. Okay? Please make a motion.
I make a motion to approve.
Second.
Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? The motion is approved 5-0. Next item on our agenda is the council action items. The first one is the Mountain Estates preliminary plat and plat variance. Michael, are you going to handle that?
Yes, sir.
It's been a long time since we've done one of these. You might need a refresher. It actually has been years since we've done a preliminary plat because of changes in the economy and such. But here we are. And as it says in your staff report or in your request for council action, the Planning Commission recommends approval of this project. I'm going to run through it and explain it to you and just discuss a few of the conditions. So it's an 18-lot subdivision on a little over roughly 3.5 acres. It's single family, although it's zoned residential medium density. And by that, what I mean is that the lot sizes are created such that it will allow single family development. So while it's in the medium density area, it could have duplexes or triplexes or could have single family. This is platted in a way that it wouldn't really, after approval of the final plat, be eligible for multifamily because the lot sizes are single-family sized lots. The applicant is here tonight from Mountain States Builders, and the project engineer is here as well in case you have questions for them.
Can you point them out?
Hmm?
Can you tell us?
We'll ask them to wave. Joe, and then okay. Ramon Llanos. This is engineer right behind.
Good to see you.
Joe's actually done a lot of construction in Blaine, but mostly single-family home construction or multifamily home construction. I think this is his first plat here in Blaine. The project is just north of D Street, so on this image, the north is to your left when you're looking at the screen, or I guess, yeah, to your left, even if you're looking at that one. And and as you can see, D Street there with that the odd curve at 16th Street and Lincoln Park on the right-hand side. The project has frontage on both 16th and D Street, and there will be lots. Now we've turned the image, and north is up. Lots will have frontage on 16th Street, and all the rest of the lots will have the frontage that they use on the interior street, which would be called Whitetail Loop if you approve the plat. Some of them, as you can see, have frontage on D Street, but those won't be accessing off of D Street, because this section of D Street becomes Motts Hill Parkway, and actually all of D Street is classified as a higher use street in the future. There's an arterial or such, and so driveways are strongly discouraged, and we won't allow platting of property to create new driveways onto the parkway. They'll all come from interior streets. The preliminary plat process has a series of criteria for approval. Planning Commission evaluated all of these and determined the project was substantially consistent with all of them, with a few minor variations, and there are conditions of approval to address those. One of the most notable is requesting less dedication of right-of-way. On D Street, there wouldn't be a dedication of right-of-way. Because of the classification of the street, it would typically be an 80-foot right-of-way. But because the East Plain Infrastructure Plan calls for a street design and a street cross-section that's in a 60-foot right-of-way, it's a little bit unique. As a just a standard road that hadn't been further planned, it would be an 80-foot right-of-way. Motts Hill Parkway is dedicated at a 60-foot right-of-way for the future. So this, where they're not dedicating, is actually consistent with our plan, if that makes sense. There's other rules that don't articulate the East Plain Infrastructure Plan, and those are in our standard zoning. So while it's an exception to some degree, it actually is consistent with the plan, and it allows full improvements for Motts Hill Parkway in the future with the two lanes and the shoulders and the roadside ditches and the multimodal trail on the south side. At that point, actually, the multimodal trail would fit in the right-of-way if we wanted it, but at that point it's going to be in Lincoln Park. Because we have the opportunity to put it further from the road, we will.
Can you folks hear him? Okay, you need to
speak. Is it not? Matt, maybe it's that. Sorry.
Sound system is not
a little bit louder.
So the what I was explaining was that the project will not be dedicating frontage on an additional right-of-way on D Street because of the East Plain Infrastructure Plan, which calls for a 60-foot right-of-way, and there's already a 60-foot right-of-way there. It'll be fully, the full street cross-section will be able to be developed within that. There is a 10-foot dedication occurring on 16th Street, so 16th Street will get 10 feet wider in that area to allow for future development of that area. And they will, when I say future development, actually it will be very soon in the future because they'll be building it, that section of road frontage. And here is where it says that. It'll be 16th Street will be improved with curb, gutter, and sidewalk along the property frontage. D Street will be improved with a widened shoulder, a curb, and storm drainage. There'll be a crosswalk in front of the project at Whitetail Loop that crosses D Street to get to Lincoln Park. And as I mentioned, that there will be in the future the multimodal trail that comes through Lincoln Park. It's actually part of the sewer project that goes through there. It's one of the conditions of the sewer project, and it all was designed to happen at the same time. So the this becomes, they will contribute towards that because of not having to put in the multimodal trail or a sidewalk. They'll contribute some funds towards that that trail when it goes in across the street. Street trees will be required adjacent to the rights-of-way, and, of course, there'll be street lighting on the Whitetail Loop interior road and then also at the intersection where it comes out onto D Street. There is a request for a plat variance as part of this, and a plat variance allows someone to vary from the platting standards. And much like what I was explaining with Motts Hill Parkway earlier, where our standards for an arterial are an 80-foot right-of-way and the Motts Hill Parkway design is a 60-foot right-of-way, in the for a standard residential street, our design standards require a 60-foot right-of-way, which is fairly significant when you consider that we have a 28-foot cross-section of street with the two travel lanes, the parking lane, sidewalk on one side of the street is our residential street standard. And so in some instances that can be done that where you can build the full improvements with less right-of-way, and the applicant has demonstrated that and requested the variance, which is supported by Public Works after, I will say, quite a bit of back and forth with Raven and the engineer on the project, and her assurance that she's evaluated that all of the infrastructure can fit into the rights-of-way and the easement. And what will be there is the 40-foot dedicated right-of-way, a 10-foot exclusive easement on one side of the street for the city, a 10-foot exclusive easement on the other side of the street, and then a 5-foot private utility easement for things like Comcast and telephone. So all of the improvements will fit within the 40-foot right-of-way, and then there'll be extra room for utility improvements on the outside of the curb and the outside of the right-of-way. The variance criteria are listed here, and again, it's sort of an exception from the standard platting rules, and they've demonstrated that that will work in this instance and that it will create a neighborhood that makes a lot of sense. We probably would not have recommended approval of this to the Planning Commission if this had been a through road of some kind, but it goes in and it's just a loop road. It'll never serve more than 16 homes or 15 homes, however many are on it. If it were going somewhere further, you likely might have heard a different response here. Staff concurs with the Planning Commission's recommendation of approval based, of course, on the findings of fact and their conditions. There are 18 findings of fact in the Planning Commission recommendation and 23 conditions of approval. Many of those conditions of approval are pretty standard things that we just, it's part of the processing, and then some of the others were related to amendments. I would mention the applicant and his engineer have both been really responsive through the project and worked very well with staff. We appreciate that. And that's all I have for this, unless you have questions for me. And this is not an ordinance item, by the way. We approve planned unit developments by ordinance because they create new zoning effectively. The plat just requires an action by council.
Does this have a first and second reading, or is this?
It doesn't have a second reading because it not being an ordinance item, so it doesn't require one.
First reading. Okay.
Questions, Michael?
Sure. Yes, sir.
The pathway on Mott's Parkway,
mm-hmm.
refresh my mind, it seemed to me that pathway was in the middle of the road.
No, sir.
It's always going to be on the south side of that?
It's not always going to be on the south side. Based on the designs that we've been putting forward and looking through with the infrastructure plan, is it likely will be on the north side until it gets to Allen Street, and at Allen it will switch to the south side. And eventually enter Lincoln Park when it gets to that area, and then come down through just like the sewer line does onto, I believe that is 14th, comes out on 14th Street.
Will they be accessing sewer through 16th or the new line going through the park?
I'm sorry, will they be, they'll be accessing sewer on the one that runs along the border. So this actually flows downhill to near the truck crossing, and it will not be using the sewer that we're proposing to build through Lincoln Park. It neither relies on it nor will it use it. Even if it comes through, it won't use it.
Okay, that's good.
And that's just the way the sewer shed sets up. Mm-hmm. It that line really starts serving properties just past this and just uphill from this. Okay.
Michael, can you put the map up showing the whole.
That one?
Yeah, that one. My question really is, that's a two-way street all the way around that loop, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Was it ever considered to be a one-way street?
No.
And why would that be?
Well, it could be a one-way loop if we wanted it to be. There's not necessarily a big advantage one way or another, except for people are likely to go whichever direction is most convenient and easiest for them. This isn't going to be a place where they're going to necessarily worry a lot about traffic or worry a lot about the police enforcing it, because it's just a quiet little loop road. And it's just better for people to always expect traffic to be always going both ways rather than to have to worry about the person who occasionally says, boy, it's a lot easier for me, for example, lot 6 up there near the top. If you were coming out of that and you were required to go right to leave your house, that makes you have to drive twice as long to get out, which isn't very far, but a lot of people might say, I can just go that way, there's no one coming. So that was never on the table.
The only question I would have is the entry where you're looking at lots 17 and 18. Those people have to cut across traffic, is that right?
I have an image of that. They wouldn't have to, or they could, depending upon which way they were going. I want to see if I have that image. Yeah, here we go. So,
Dennis, what's the question on 17 and 18?
If you had a one-way street, you would always be going around the same way, and then the entry would just be to the left or to the right, depending on which lot you want to go into.
Well, that could be true, but if you think about it on most all streets, if you want to go left or you want to go right when you go out of your driveway, you're guaranteed to have to cross traffic if you want to go one direction or the other. And so this is just typical of that scenario, where when I leave my driveway, if I want to go to the left, I'm crossing traffic. And when I want to go right, I'm going with traffic. And that's the case in essentially all circumstances. So you're right, it is the case here, but that would be typical.
A one-way street wouldn't allow on-street parking either.
Well, the one-way street could allow on-street parking.
Well, if you made it wide enough, yes.
Yeah, we wouldn't make it, actually, we wouldn't make it any narrower necessarily. And again, the one-way street, what would happen, what I would, I can't speak for the people who live in house lot 17 and lot 18, but I can speak for myself. And if I lived in lot 18 and you were to ask me to turn right when I left my driveway and go all the way around the corner to leave the neighborhood, there's a real good possibility when I looked out and saw no one coming, I'd cross the street and go out the other way. It's the way people behave.
Michael, are there any issues with the fire department in this kind of setup?
No, the fire department is fine with it. They've reviewed turning radii, and they have no concerns about the design.
Okay.
They were involved in the request for the lesser width.
Could I ask the owners or you about what price range you might be talking about for your homes? Are they going to be built on spec, or are you just selling lots?
So I don't have the answer to that question, but I'm sure Mr. Imperial can provide some information on the product that they intend to create.
Okay.
Any other questions for me before I turn over the microphone?
I was just going to ask about the landscaping plan. Is that just normal?
The only landscaping that is different than just typical will be along D Street, where there's a required 5-foot setback, landscape setback for the fence, and that is part of the lots that are being created. 12, 13, and 14 have frontage on two streets. Those are what we call through lots. And as a result of that, on the side that faces the main road that you're not allowed to access, our code requires that there be a landscape buffer there, so that there's not a fence right out at the edge, and so also that it just kind of makes it look a little nicer. So that's the only place there'll be a landscaping plan required for us. The rest of it is just regular residential neighborhood landscaping.
But you're going to have a plan for that.
We'll have a plan for the D Street frontage, but we don't receive plans for regular single-family homes.
No, I know that. Yeah. I mean, along the D Street, you're going to have a plan that's going to...
We will. And it'll be lower at the corners for visibility, and it'll, you know, be allowed to get taller as you move away from the corner. It's pretty straightforward.
Oh, I do have one more question, Michael. Is there a threshold number of homes for a development like this where a park is required?
There's not a specific numeric threshold. If a project got large enough, we could begin to go into sort of negotiations regarding dedicating land, creating a park, that kind of thing. If it were a planned unit development, which is typically quite a bit larger, recreational amenities are part of the package for what's required for the planned unit development arrangement. But for something this size, we wouldn't expect a park typically, and I wouldn't have requested one. Also, there's a park directly across the street. Which, and people have pointed out, but there's no playground in there or that sort of thing.
Right.
It's like that's true, but we can't maintain, the city can't maintain a playground in every single cul-de-sac or a playground for every 20 lots. It's just not feasible.
Yeah.
There is actually in the Lincoln Park plan, a plan for a very nice playground to be built at the south side of the park so people could easily walk from here, walk down through the park, and go to a nice big playground.
Yeah.
The next nearest playground that is likely to come into existence is up near Jerome Street at the East Maple Ridge area, because at that point there's a much larger group of people in the 350 lots in East Maple Ridge.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Michael, go ahead, Dennis. Go ahead.
Michael, on the stormwater, there's a detention pond.
Yes.
Does that collect everything from within the development? Is that the plan?
Yes, it does. The drainage, because the land, it's not really apparent, certainly not on this image, but I don't know that you have anything in your package that really shows it. The land slopes quite a bit from the D Street and to the right side of the image towards 16th Street. And so the pond is right on the way to capture all that. There will be some runoff, like from the driveways on lots 1 and 2, will just go out into the gutter. which is allowed. A certain amount of that water is allowed to do that, particularly because it will all be in the calculations. And it'll be accounted for so that that water is known to be going that way. Lots 1 and 2, their gutters will be directed towards the back. They'll go into the detention pond.
Now, that detention pond, does it have an outlet?
Yes, it goes out into the stormwater system that runs down 16th Street and heads north.
And that'll be piped? Or?
It'll be piped here. I don't know that it's piped the entire way, all the way to the border.
Michael, does this require a homeowners association?
It doesn't require one. Our code for planned unit developments does, but for a long plat does not. So they may opt to have one. It's very typical these days for someone to have a homeowners association because they get to control things like front yard landscaping, and they may not want to have RVs parked in the front yards and things like that. That's really Mr. Impero's decision at this point, whether as the property owner he wants to impose those additional restrictions. But it's not required. He has the right to do that, but it's not required.
Who maintains that detention pond? Is that
the homeowners? The homeowners will, and actually that's a great point. I stand corrected. The homeowners association will be required to be formed to maintain the detention pond. That's the only thing that's required for here. Yeah. And then the city has the right to step in and do the maintenance and build them if the homeowners don't properly maintain it.
Okay. No. Go ahead, buddy.
Okay. Yeah, I just happened to think about this. As to your knowledge, to your best of your knowledge, there will be no problems with runoff onto the home on the corner into their property?
The one that's on that missing piece there? It'd be very unlikely because of the slope of the land. The water wants to go away from them, most of it. And everything on 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, those are going to be their downspouts and their driveways will drain towards the street or the in underground into the stormwater system.
Okay, that's good.
So
I know that's happened on occasion with other developments. It's just an unintended consequence. I just wanted to be sure.
Can I comment on that, Michael?
Sure, please.
So development is not supposed to change historical drainage. So the historical flow here is northwesterly. So quite a bit of the flow actually coming off D Street is going through that parcel. Mm. So this will actually dry up that parcel quite a bit because it's picking up water from the homes and so forth, which right now is sloping toward that property.
Okay.
So I'd be very surprised. I'm not disagreeing with Michael, but just to let you know that since that is the historical drainage pattern, still should be and could be some drainage going on in that. Okay.
Good.
Michael, do you know if there's any plan to how they're going to build this? Is it going to be one or two houses started?
That would be a great question for Mr. Impero. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, because it would be interesting to know how they're going to start the building of that process. Do you do one and two, or do you do closer to D Street?
Anything else for me? It sounds like you have a couple questions for the owner.
On the crosswalk on D Street, how do the folks in the development access that? Is that crosswalk right across from the entrance, or where would it be?
Well, the crosswalk is on the map that's up on the wall. It's the series of dashed lines going across D Street. They'll just walk from a sidewalk onto the crosswalk, and we'll have to be installed a culvert on the south side because there's a ditch on the other side of D Street, but there'll be a culvert that goes in, and then people will be able to walk directly into Lincoln Park.
Would children be able to walk directly to school through Lincoln Park?
They can, yeah. There's a trail system, and they pop out onto, I'm dying to say, at Leroy's house, because I can't remember the name of the street. 8th Street? At E Street. And then you can go down past Burger King on the 14th Street Trail and cross at 8th Street. I'm sure people do that today. Or you can just walk down D Street. It's not ideal yet to walk from here down D Street because there isn't the trail, but you could. I imagine people who live just to the west of here probably do that because there's a bridge and you don't have to go across H Street on a crosswalk. You can just walk across the truck route. You can just walk across the top of it.
Any other questions for Michael?
Okay.
Joe
has some answers for you.
Property development, the developer. Bonnie has some questions. Would you like to come forward? microphone and we can ask those questions.
He makes you the spokesperson.
I am the spokesperson because I'm also the real estate person. Okay. My name is Christy Imperio. I'm with Mountain States Builders as well as Century 21. Our vision for this is going to meet the needs of the community. We're looking at starter homes up to 2,000 square feet. We're looking at probably about the 240 to the 290 mark. We're hoping to put a couple of bigger homes in there, 2,000 square feet. That'll probably reach right up to about 290. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your plan is, how are you going to start off? Are you going to build one or two homes, or are you going to?
Joe and I typically do two to four. To start with.
And that will be off of D Street, or will you go there?
You know, our plan originally was to do one and two and get those going, because if you go up there and you look on 16th Street, just on the other side of two, there's a brand new home, and then there was an older home that was purchased, renovated, and sold as well, very fast. They sold very quickly. And so we were thinking finish that off first so that those neighbors weren't as disrupted, because they just moved there. So get those two done and out of the way. And maybe if we were to do a couple of smaller homes, those might be the lots, if we could maybe hit the 235 mark, because that will bring in maybe some first-time home buyers. Get that done and then look at the other ones as far as size and which lots to start in.
I'm sure it depends on the market.
It does.
You know, it does.
There's a huge need for housing here in the city. We found that last summer. We built the last four that we built, they were all pending within 30 days of completion, and there was lots of people looking for homes in Blaine.
Mm-hmm. Where have you built before in Blaine?
We have done the corner development that actually resembles this on the corner of Anderson and Harborview, right up from the water slides. It's called Breeze Loop. We did that. We built every home in there.
Okay.
And that was kind of the same.
Yeah.
And it was off of a main road, and it had a loop, and except for the differences, the retention pond was in the middle.
Uh-huh.
And that was what Whatcom County wanted, so that's what we did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very successful, very nice neighborhood. Yeah. We always landscape the front and the back of all of our homes, so nobody moves in and has any dirt. It's all landscaped front and back. So it'll be nice.
Well, we encourage you. We're glad to see you. We're very excited.
Yeah. It's been great working with the city. They are really, really good.
Great.
It's going to be good.
So if this passes tonight, you'll build tomorrow?
Well, we'll get the excavator up there.
Well, you're getting into the season for it.
So. Yeah, we are. Perfect timing.
Yeah.
Further questions? Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Appreciate you coming forward. Okay, unless, let me just read you what the recommendation is. The staff concurs with the Planning Commission's recommendation of approval and suggests the council make a motion to approve the Mountain Estates preliminary plat and plat variance based on the findings of fact and subject to the conditions of approval contained in the Planning Commission's recommendation.
I move approval.
Second.
Okay. Motion has been made and second. Are there any other questions or comments? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Say nay. Motion is carried 5-0. The next item on our agenda is Ordinance 16-2877, amending the Semiahmoo Shore PUD. Michael, I assume that's going to be you.
That is also me, yes.
Well, I hope that the Mountain Estates plat goes much quicker to construction than the Semiahmoo Shore project. This project has had a long background, but I'm really pleased to see the project moving forward now and the new construction that's out there. If you've been out on Semiahmoo Spit, you've seen one of the units, well, it's actually two units in one building, which has been under construction for a while. The exterior is basically done, and it is on one of the duplex lots within this development. So it was able to move forward, and the nice thing about it is it gives you an opportunity to see the plans in 3D for the future. First of all, this is Semiahmoo Shore. It used to be Seagrass Cottages, and it's on the plat of Seagrass, Division 1. There was no Division 2, so it's the plat of Seagrass, Division 1. But it's no longer, it's like the artist formerly known as Prince. It's no longer known as Seagrass. It's now Semiahmoo Shore. And it is a project, if you approve it, of 23 duplexes and one 16-plex. The 16-plex was previously part of the project, so that remains the same. And there was a group of duplexes proposed at the end of the cul-de-sac, and then two duplexes, one of which is under construction now as part of the project. The rest of the buildings were fourplexes, and so this would change it all to 23 duplexes. In total, that's 62 dwelling units. Last year, you approved a reduction in density for this area from 68 units to 62 units, so this is consistent with that. It's on about 17 acres. A portion of this project requires a shoreline substantial development permit, but that was already approved by the Planning Commission. The way state law is set up, the Planning Commission has authority over shoreline substantial development permits, so that's been conditionally approved, but it needs this to be approved as well, or the shoreline permit doesn't really mean anything because they can't make those changes without the PUD amendment as well. The applicant is here, as well as various representatives from the applicant's group. And this is what the project looks like conceptually. You'll recognize Semiahmoo Spit with the water on both sides, Semiahmoo Parkway threading up the middle, and most of the road out there is already constructed, and all of the water, most of the roads for this project, I mean, which is called Turnstone Lane, is already constructed, and all the water, sewer, electrical infrastructure is in the ground. The most of the stormwater infrastructure is in the ground, except the stormwater infrastructure for each individual home. Those are infiltration trenches, essentially, that are underground, and once the home is built, they're built as percolation basins that are underground. They'll be hidden under the landscape. That's always been the plan, so that's about the only infrastructure that's not in place. That and one piece down there that I just highlighted with yellow, which is the cul-de-sac, was for what would have been Division 2 or Phase 2, and they're proposing to just go ahead and do that. And there's no need to plat those lots, so there won't be a future subdivision. It'll just be all one lot, those group of homes, and they'll be under the homeowners association just like all the rest of the property, all the other homeowners within this project. So this looks a little weird because it's cattywampus, but I tilted it the same way the rest were tilted, and this is the project plan. It essentially shows the duplexes. One of the things that's notable on here is there's a dashed line that kind of V's down and then V's back off. And that shows the shoreline jurisdiction. So in the interior of the project, things are not within shoreline jurisdiction. In the exterior of the project, things are within shoreline jurisdiction, and that's why it needed a shoreline permit, and that has been through that process already. This is what it used to look like. This was the design formerly, and you can see it's really relatively the same layout, the same pattern, but it is including fourplexes, whereas now it would be duplexes. And then the one building that's highlighted towards the top on this just happens to be where the 16-plex would go, and that would still be the same lot where it could potentially go in the future. And this is what it looks like in the Resort Semiahmoo Master Plan, very, very consistent with not only what we just showed you, but with the slide a couple back, which is the Semiahmoo Shore proposal. And this, as I mentioned, you approved this general pattern, which, of course, is what's on the ground out there today with the road, and the reduction in density to 62 units back in December of last year. The reason that we're here is because this is not something that's administratively approvable. Our PUD code allows for PUD modifications that I can approve and PUD amendments that come back to you for approval. If it exceeds a 5% change in density or unit count, then it is an amendment, not a modification. So 68 to 62 is an amendment because that's more than 5%. It also arguably alters the architectural concept enough that you have to revise the master plan, from the fourplex to duplex, that's another one of the standards. So it is going, it comes to you because of that. If they had only changed one or two units, up or down, then it could have been administratively approved. And what it says is these are processed in the same manner as a PUD application, meaning they go plant neighborhood meeting, planning commission, city council. There are no criteria for approval for a PUD amendment, specifically. Basically, that what we rely on in that instance is the standard zoning code that is in the public good, it's not detrimental to the health, safety, and welfare, is it compliant with the comp plan, and is it compliant with the intent of the zoning code. So we didn't expect the amendment to meet our exact PUD criteria of approval, first of all, because it's not a PUD, it's just an amendment to a PUD. But more importantly, this project, the Seagrass project, was approved before we adopted our new PUD standards. So it doesn't exactly match. Ironically, our PUD standards were adopted in part to mimic some of what was done in Seagrass. So to a great extent, it matches everything, but there are a few things that are off. But as I said, that's not the criteria of approval. The criteria of approval are just general compliance with the code. One topic that was more notable than some of the others was the request for additional impervious surface. In the original Resort Semiahmoo Master Plan, they were allowed to have 40% impervious surface. That's the largest amount on this chart. The Semiahmoo Shore project requests 4.9%, so it's still quite a bit below the Master Plan's allowance. In the Seagrass project, though, there was extra attention towards it reducing impervious surface at the time. I don't know all the reasons for that. I wasn't there. Mr. Robinson knew her. But this would be a request to increase impervious surface from that approval by about 1.2 acres. And again, though, still well below what the Resort Semiahmoo Master Plan allowed. The project conditions are minimal because most of the things were already done. Most of the things that were required for the Seagrass project, build the road, build the trails, dedicate easements, build the shelter, build the stormwater system, develop CCNRs, all of those kinds of things, those have basically all been done because this has already been platted. Now we are requesting some new conditions of approval, submit revised CCNRs because there's changes to the duplexes and a variety of other things, but most of them are really pretty minimal because most of the check boxes have already been checked off. And as a result, many of those conditions go away. The commission recommends approval, and staff concurs with that recommendation. There are 19 findings of fact in your staff report and 9 conditions of approval. This would be approved by ordinance because it's a PUD amendment, and the PUD was approved by ordinance, so we need you to take a similar level of action to change that recommendation, the former approval. So if you concur with the Planning Commission's recommendation, we would request that you waive the second reading and approve Ordinance 162877. Just as with the prior project, the applicant and their representatives are here. They can answer lots of questions about landscaping and design and the number of units that they've had people interested in and all sorts of things like that. Any questions for me?
Michael, what's the total number of units?
62.
So you end up with 62?
62 homes.
And how many lots?
That's a great question. These are tracts. They multiple homes, multiple buildings sit on one parcel. So there are about 6 tracts altogether, but I don't know because we're not treating them individually that way. But for example, the cul-de-sac at the end, all 6 of those units are on one lot. Or 7, in fact, are on one lot, and so it's about 5 or 6 lots total.
So if someone buys a unit, are they just buying the building?
They are condominiums, so they're buying the airspace within the condominiums and the interior walls. So, yeah, they're sort of just buying the building, but they're, in fact, only buying half the building unless they buy both condominiums by both sides.
But those would end up fee simple then for the owner?
No, fee simple means you own the land underneath, and so they would be condominium. They own the box with inside the building.
Okay. Go ahead, buddy.
All the open space around it, And I assume they had to leave a certain amount to be able to get the impervious surfaces, possibly. Maybe that has something. But anyway, there's quite a bit over here as well as here. Is that just going to be kind of gone natural, natural grasses?
Yes and no, and if you've been out there recently, the landscaping or the nature of the land is actually pretty close today to what the long-term plan is. There will be some changes to that because it will be planted a little bit more, and plantings will be replaced. But the landscape plan is predominantly, almost exclusively native species, and it's things like shore pines and grasses and salal and native roses and other things like that. So you'll see areas where it's sort of like low rolling dunes almost, and then other areas that become a little bit forested, much like the county park. Mm-hmm. Now when they're within the what's called the patio zone, the people have more flexibility and the developer has more flexibility to do a little bit more of a garden kind of design, but it still is predominantly native species.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to ask the owners about the same question I asked the previous people.
And I'm sure they'd be happy to answer it. And the landscape architect is here as well. He can probably tell you tons of things about the landscaping that I can't.
Michael, did the changing of these buildings, does that increase or decrease the amount of parking that would be?
It doesn't change the amount of parking that's required. The except for that it goes from 68 units to 62 units. That reduces the amount. But our parking standard is 2 parking spaces per multifamily or per single family duplex. It's the same per unit, 2 per unit. And then there's some additional guest parking on the street, and everyone has a 2-car garage, and almost and essentially every unit also has 2 cars can park on the driveway.
So public would park where? I mean, or visitors would
Park either in someone's driveway or in some of the visitor parking, which is that you can see on this plan in a couple places there are some bump outs where the road gets a little wider. It sort of curves out. Those are parking spaces for guests.
Guest parking.
Yeah.
And the walkway or the pathway, where does that go through there?
Which pathway, sir? There's a lot of them there.
I'm walking from the beach walkers down.
Yeah, if you're walking from Beachwalker down, you'd walk along the orange line on the shore there on the side towards the sailboat. And then on the side towards the bottom, towards where it says Semiahmoo Shore, there's also the orange line marked trail. That's the paved path. So there's a path that crosses. You can see it on the lower left that crosses the spit with a crosswalk over the parkway. That's a gravel trail. And then all the trails on the north side are gravel trails. The trails on the south side, with a couple exceptions, are all paved. They're gravel on the north side because it's a more natural kind of environment. But when you're down by the road, it's the paved trail.
Okay. Now remind me what our requirements are for building. There's a limit as to when you can build and when you can't build.
So there are limits on when you can do construction or exterior construction out there, and there also are some limits on when you can do heavy equipment excavation out there. And as you know from some of the other projects that we've dealt with, including some city projects, we've found through various studies that we were probably a little overly protective or a little extra conservative back a decade or so ago when this was approved. And so when they went through SEPA again, we kept the same restrictions in place, except that we moved the windows in by 1 month. So whereas you used to have to stop construction in October, now you have to stop construction in November. And when you used to not be able to start until April, now you can start in March, kind of still protecting that heaviest concentration window.
So that from March to
November.
Yeah, so they... Yeah, and there's a little bit of there's also some flexibility in there where if they have a biologist come and observe and demonstrate that there's not an issue, they can potentially get a waiver of a little bit longer. But they are on a pretty aggressive timeline and have a very well-calculated construction process, and we've talked quite a bit about that. My concern is I don't really want unfinished buildings sitting out all winter because it's not great for them, and it's not great for the city. It's not really good for anyone. So we're going to work to try and make sure everything gets indoors so that they can continue work all winter on those buildings. But I'm sure that Mr. Crocker or someone can talk to you a little bit about how many they're proposing this summer. It's a pretty significant number.
So the idea is to get, by the time you get to November, you've done the exterior work.
Right. You're indoors.
You're indoors.
Yeah.
Michael, you said that the stormwater was an infiltration system?
Yeah, primarily.
Is there any problem with high tides and winds affecting that?
No, not really. The elevation out there is about 14 feet above sea level, so that's even with like a storm tide, there's still going to be groundwater infiltration occurring out there. There are definitely other issues related to the high tides and strong winds out there, and it'll probably be beach erosion and things blowing around, but there still should be no problem with infiltration. The ground out there perks at a phenomenal rate because it's basically sand and gravel.
Another question, Harry.
Yes, buddy.
So on here, on the drawing is shown 46 units, so and they're approved for 62. So the other 16, will that be done in the larger unit buildings? There'll be one or two of them.
Probably
area.
One building, unless
just
they get a change.
About 16?
Yeah, so it would be, okay. If you can imagine something like one of the Marin buildings, those have 18 right. units in them.
They do, okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I was going to ask if that was the plan was to build that building first. After, I know they've got some construction.
That's not even shown here.
Mr. Crocker can speak to that, but if you want details on it, but they have made it clear that that is not their plan. They basically, at this point, have no plans to build that building.
Okay. Gotcha. Further questions for Michael?
There was a question about project timing and other things.
Okay. The owners could come forward. Apparently we have some questions for you. If you'd be kind enough to come forward, we can address them. Be kind enough to state your name and address for the record.
My name's Paul George, landscape architect, and I'm from Bellingham. Good.
Bonnie, you have a question.
Well, it's not really landscaping, but just wondering what price range, I don't expect any firm numbers, but just a general price range, possibility, and about how soon and how many units you're planning on getting going soon.
Price range would be about 980.
Okay.
Excuse me, sir. That will not pick up on our recording unless you come forward, please.
If you'd be kind enough just to come to the mic, please. We would appreciate it. Be kind enough just to state your name again.
Sure.
So the record, for the record.
Bill Crocker. I'm with the developer, DBW Properties, and I live in Bellingham.
Okay.
And the high range, I said, was about 980,000, 990 for 3,000 square foot, give or take a few. We have some on the inside of are going to be about 2,000 square feet.
Per unit?
Pardon?
Per unit? 2,000
yes,
per unit?
Yes, per unit.
Right.
And they're going to probably be in the 700,000, okay. 650 to 700,000.
Okay.
And the CCNRs from the Semiahmoo Resort Association are going to apply?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we're a member of them. We've already got that handled. And their plan is to start 5 buildings this summer.
Okay.
And complete 5 buildings this year.
on which side of the road?
It'll be on the
south side.
Semiahmoo's the bay side.
The
not Drayton Harbor, but the other side.
Yeah.
South side.
Oh, okay.
Right next to Beachwalk.
West side.
Okay.
The first three
southwest
to five units.
Yeah.
Is their plan?
Yeah. Nice view ones. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And those are going to be in the 3,000 square foot range per side.
Looks like a really nice plan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We think so.
Yeah.
We hope so, anyway.
Yeah.
So March is coming up, so are you ready to
get
started?
We're getting ready. Oh, yes. We're signing contracts and doing everything that's necessary to have a start date.
Yeah.
Yes. Any other questions? Dennis?
Nope. I'm done.
Okay. Thank you very, very,
yes.
very much.
Thank you.
Okay, now... The recommendation is the Planning Commission recommends approval of the application. Staff recommends the Council approve Ordinance Number 162877, approving the planned unit development amendment for Semiahmoo Shore on the plat of Seagrass Division 1 and waive the second reading.
So moved.
Second.
Been moved and second. Are there any comments or questions? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed say nay. Motion is carried 5-0. The next item on our agenda is the labor contract agreement. Mr. City Manager.
Evening, Council members and Mayor. Tonight I'm going to be asking the Council to approve a pay increase that's been negotiated with the electrical unit for the City Light. In the past years, the City and the Electrical Union have had a list of organizations that they compare to for salary increases or adjustments. These include Orcas, Power and Light, Pittitas PUD, Perry County PUD, City of Steilacoom, City of Milton, City of Sumas, City of Cheney, and Whatcom PUD. And the way we go about this is to check to see what those organizations' salaries are, and we or hourly rate, and we compare those hourly rates to our rate. Last year, we started the negotiations, and the Council approved approximately a 10% increase for those wages relative to the market. Like my theory is, and I think it's pretty common across the board, that salaries and wages are based on retention and recruitment. So we want to maintain a market condition. And so once we reach that last year's negotiation, the agreement last year was that that would do a rate increase, and we had a 10% no-cap insurance. That was a really high priority for the Council. They agreed to that. We also agreed for a reopener for this coming year based upon the same methodology. We go back and survey the cities, look at the rates. So we've done that work, and this year those numbers are 1.54%, which is where we think they should be. And that should be very similar in the next future as the City manages, you know, COLA or CPI as much as other cities would be doing the same. So we're recommending that the Council authorize the mayor's signature on just an amendment to the contract at a 1.54% increase for 2016.
Questions?
You want a motion?
Comments? Well, yes, I'd be glad to entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Motion has been made and second. Are there any further questions or comments? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Thank
you,
Council.
Say nay. Motion is carried 5-0. Next item on our agenda is Commission, Committee, and Board reports. First one off is the Blaine Economic Development Advisory Committee. Mr. City Manager.
Next meeting is next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m.
What's the date of that?
March 1st.
March 1st.
March 1st, 2 p.m.?
3 p.m.
3 p.m. Okay. Steve, do you have any on the Blaine Tourism Advisory Committee?
No report.
No report. Bonnie, how about the Chamber of Commerce?
No report.
Okay. Charlie, Drayton Harbor Shellfish Advisory Committee.
The oyster shop downtown is back in business. So.
Okay.
Glad they got best of bite.
I know.
That's great.
That's good. Dennis, do you have any on your three committees?
On March 18th is the Bob Millman concert.
Do you have tickets for this?
You can get the tickets over at the library. Or you might get attacked on the street. It just depends. I won't do that. Senior Center, March 16th, there's a fundraiser. They're having a dinner for the Meals on Wheels Fund.
Good.
And the Boys and Girls Club is open.
Yes.
Yeah, the pavilion. Fantastic looking, as far as I was concerned. Mm-hmm. Beautiful building, wonderful for the Boys and Girls Club.
Just one other thing. The Wings Over Water, the library has a book sale going on, and there is a breakfast at the Senior Center that Saturday.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis. Michael, anything on the Planning Commission and Park and Cemetery Board?
The Planning Commission has finished up a draft of the Economic Development Chapter of the Comprehensive Plan. That'll probably come to you at your next meeting, and they're working on the transportation element this Thursday, and nothing from the Park and Cemetery Board.
Good. Okay. Raven, on the Public Works Advisory Committee.
Our next meeting is March 3rd at 10 a.m.
Small Cities Caucus, we met last week, and we're at the Bellingham Technical College, and we had a presentation and had an opportunity to talk about what new opportunities are going to be happening at the college, so it was very informative. Finance Committee, Jeff is not here. So we'll pass on that. Whatcom Council of Governments, nothing to report on that. We have the North Whatcom Fire Update, Chief Hollander. We're excited to have him here.
Good evening, Council. Share with you our chief's report for January. 1 month of statistics so far. For the month of January, we responded to 315 calls. One major fire save. Almost $1 million worth of property. And that was the radio station on Lincoln Road. I apologize, I don't know the exact initials of it. It's K-A-R-I. Thank you very much. One of those typical fire calls, 2:30 in the morning for an alarm activation. And 99% of the time we get out of bed, get in the fire trucks, race down there, lights and siren. Well, we don't use the siren in the middle of the night. First thing crews report, nothing. So they get out, check with flashlights, they look in the windows, and sure enough, the smoke is down inside the building, halfway down into the floor. So there was electrical fire in the ceiling, and the crews did a great job saving almost all of the building. I think we had $15,000, $16,000 worth of damage to the radio studio itself. So just goes to show you those smoke alarms really work. On the commercial buildings, of course, they're maintained and monitored. And so that worked really well in this case. And had we not had that fire alarm go off, that building would have eventually completely caught on fire. So I know 99% of the time our crews just go, it's just another one of those fire alarms.
Yep.
But you got to treat everyone like the real thing, because occasionally we do have those. 77 calls for the Blaine city limits, 70 in the city, and 7 out in Semiahmoo. And a response time out in Semiahmoo is a little bit better this month, 11 minutes. And in the city limits, it's 7 minutes for an average response time. And the rest of that, I think I'll just let you read at your leisure, unless you have any specific questions.
I just wish we could ever address that Vasquez machine. It just drives me crazy seeing those. The trains are getting longer and longer. The time is getting longer and longer.
I feel it. I either leave my office at 4:30 or 5:15, because in between, I'm sitting at the train.
Yeah, I know. It's just terrible. I think, I don't even know how that we would even address that with Homeland Security. No one seems to have any access to them, and we certainly can't get them to any of our elected officials to do anything. I mean, they just shake their head and go, it's Homeland Security.
And I don't have any different answer to give you either.
It just bothers the hell out of me. Thank you, Chief.
Okay,
appreciate it. Okay, next item on our agenda is department reports. We have Public Works Project Updates. We have Raven. Let's go ahead and keep us informed.
Yes, sir. Couple of things going on with rail. I just wanted to give you an update on that. We have our second student group that are working on a survey right now to try to get information primarily north of the border of who will actually take train, but we did get it in the paper. It should be in the paper this week, and thanks to Councilmember Onion's critical eye, we're also going to get it in our utility bill.
Perfect.
And their work is actually gathered quite a bit of attention, and they will be actually speaking at the annual Spring Rail Conference of the All Aboard Washington group. And I am thinking that someone from the city should be there because they are literally presenting on the merits of Amtrak Cascade Stop in Blaine, Washington. Today was the last day for the discounted rate on a ticket, so I bought a ticket. So I want to offer that ticket to one of you if you would like to go. It's Saturday, March 5th in Tukwila, and it's conveniently located so you could take the train. So please let me know if you're interested. I really think that you know, this group is going to include people from the NARP. I forget what that stands for. Ron Pate with the WashDOT, Rob Eaton with Amtrak Government Affairs, and then the student presentation. And the students are actually being provided a scholarship to attend through the Surrey Board of Trade. And that was a connection that we made when we presented to IMTC.
Raven, are you going to be there?
I am hoping one of you will go because I have a commitment, but my commitment is in the general area if I need to go. How's that for an honest answer?
What day of the week is that?
It's a Saturday. Saturday, March 5th.
Was there a meeting time?
It starts at 11 and it goes to 5:15. And it includes lunch. Would you like to hear the menu?
No, but again, the agenda is
implementation of higher speed rail infrastructure projects in the Northwest, operation of current service, look into 2017 service expansion, reports on state rail advocacy activities in the Northwest, report on national passenger rail advocacy.
Do you know if there's going to any legislators going to be there?
It doesn't speak to that specifically. I can ask the question.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, my thought on it was, like I said, they're speaking on our behalf, so I think we want to shoulder them along. So we bought a seat to that.
What I would suggest is that if anyone's interested, they contact you.
Mm-hmm. That would be outstanding.
I'll check my agenda. See if that,
thank you.
Works with
whatever. No pressure. Mm-hmm. No pressure. Let's see. We had talked about having a joint meeting with Birch Bay Water and Sewer District to kind of talk about this whole North County water supply, and then this grant came through. So instead of doing a joint study session, I've invited Dan Isis with Birch Bay Water and Sewer District to just do a study session with you all in the meeting, in the first meeting of March, if we're able to get that on the schedule, that would just talk about the intent of the grant money and the approach that he's taking with Department of Ecology and so forth. And then as we start having some results from that work, then bring that to you all as a joint study session. It seemed like it was a much better use of everybody's time. It also keeps you from having an extra meeting. So trying to be sensitive there.
So he's going to be at our next meeting, is that?
I've put it on our calendar, and we'll confirm that tomorrow when we start talking about the agenda officially, but I didn't see anything else lined up for that yet. On a couple of AWC things, they have sent out a training needs survey. They need responses by the 2nd of March. Have all of you received that?
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, this is about you and your needs, and I'm on the education committee trying to champion for small cities, so please take the time to respond. It was fairly short. I responded myself. They also have openings for their board of directors, and they do have an at-large less than 5,000 population for a two-year term. If any of you are interested in getting more involved with AWC, say I'm very impressed with the staff there and the work that they're doing, and their legislative advocates are just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So I've been very impressed. And then just a little update, I recently returned from a trip to Kansas City as a on APWA's behalf, American Public Works Association, and they're doing some good work there too. There's a lot of conversation happening around succession planning and needing to get training and inspiration at the high school level about public works, and so it's something that I'll be talking a little bit more with senior staff about, and how can we do more with the schools and just try to bring more people into this profession. So that was a big part. But as an aside, I just happened to walk back to my room after one of the night meetings with their lobbyist from D.C., and she knew nothing about the VACIS, has never spoken to Susan Delbene. So I said, do I have a job for you? And so I transferred her, or forwarded her, the email that we got from GSA. That was their audit on the rail, where Blaine was highlighted as one of the cities that's being impacted, and I will definitely be following up with her.
Sure.
Okay, so that might have been worth the trip in and of itself. I think that's all. I do have ABWC's legislative bulletin. Most of the really hot items have kind of drifted off as they're involved in other things in this session. But if you're interested in knowing more about their current hot topics, let me know.
Is everyone here on the AWC mailing list? Do you get their...
This should look very familiar then, right?
Okay. Raven, did you let Carly know about, Carly's the gal for Del Betty. Did you let her know?
I can.
I think it would be wise if you just maybe give her a phone call and just tell her that you had that opportunity in Kansas City, and maybe she can...
Maybe introduce them digitally or something.
Yeah, because she attends all our meetings, and she seems very interested.
Okay.
It's a matter of, can we do anything with getting her to... Del Benny's supposed to be out here. Do you know the dates that she's supposed to be here?
I can ask her that, too. Since
she's making a trip to Blaine. I think it doesn't have anything to do with us specifically, but I've tried to convince her that she should spend a little time with us, but I'm not getting her role.
If she's coming to Blaine, you should almost not insist, but just say, we really do need to speak with you.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, definitely.
She's going to be here.
Yeah. Yep.
Murray and Cantwell never, I don't think they get north of Everett.
No, I don't think so.
And so, we just never get an opportunity to talk.
Senator Delbene has been very responsive when I've spoken with her, too. So I will see if I can find out when she's coming to Blaine, and then I'll also try to connect her with this advocate from APWA and see if, can get something.
Del Benny's office is aware of the VACIS. We've never really had an opportunity to take her there and show her. Although I think we had a video that we sent up.
Okay. I thought that did happen.
45 minutes is crazy.
Yeah.
City Arts Society.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank
you. Thank you. Public safety.
Oh. You were going to skip me.
I did. Yes, I did. Community development.
Sorry, Mike.
My apologies.
I have a couple of quick things, but more importantly, the reason I wouldn't let you skip me is I wanted to introduce our new community planner one. Come on up here, Madeline. This is Madeline Otley, or Maddie, as she goes by. Mm-hmm. We're very, very happy to have her on board. She started on Thursday and has been doing a great job already, getting things ready for a wide variety of things, but as you're probably most interested in, enforcement. Maddie formerly worked for Ferndale for a little while, where she was the code enforcement officer, and we were lucky enough to attract her up here to Blaine. And she's a graduate of Western Washington University. I'm going to put her on the hot seat so you can ask her a couple questions or say hello if you want to.
Hey, wonderful. Welcome on board.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Maddie, how do you spell your last name?
It's Ottley.
Maybe you could give us a little bit of your experiences in Ferndale with the...
Sure. So when I started at Ferndale, it was very similar to here. They had all their codes set up, ready to go for enforcement. They hadn't started active enforcement yet. So I was the one to start their active enforcement process. And while I was there, I helped resolve about 100 cases. And that took place over 7 months. And so we hit it really hard. And At first, you get a ton of complaints, but then as time goes on, you resolve most of those spaces, they tend to go down. And, yeah, we've had great success up there, and it's helped attract new businesses, and that's a big thing for enforcement, cleaning up our community to attract more businesses coming in, make it more beautiful.
Terrific. Mm-hmm. Have you had a chance to look at our rules and regulations?
I have, yes, and they're going to be very effective.
When you were in Ferndale, other than complaints, were there any that the city was proactive about addressing?
Mm-hmm. So we mostly focused on life safety, but mm-hmm. we also wanted to get down to, like, in the summertime, it's mostly vegetation. That's mm-hmm. where most of the stuff right. comes in when you get those fire concerns. We worked with the fire department to target some properties that hadn't been maintained in 20 years, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. They just happen.
Mm-hmm. So you got pretty good response overall?
Yeah, and part of that was implementing fines. In the past, I think city councils have been kind of hesitant to do that, but it can be waived based on compliance and director's discretion, and that's how most of our enforcement cases got resolved.
Okay. Well, we want similar results here.
You got a big job, and we're looking forward to seeing some results.
I'm excited.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So a couple other quick items. One was that we were in conversation this morning, and it came up that it's been just about 2 years since the Islamic Center was approved to, with yes. a conditional use permit, to be in the Salishan neighborhood. And at that time, there was quite a bit of concern by folks about parking in the neighborhood and noise and other issues. And I drive by that center virtually every single day, or at least every single work day. And on the weekends, every now and then, I make an effort to drive by just because. And in the past 2 years, I've seen no more than two or three cars parked out on the street at on most days, occasionally a couple more than that. I think, honestly, more than half of those are people who live right there in the neighborhood, one of the neighbors on one side or another. And no complaints at all. So I'm glad that that went as we expected and as we hoped. And so no concerns there. There's one other thing I wanted to take just a second to bring up on the So that's a logo that you're going to see around town starting in the next week or two, couple weeks, and you'll see it now and again. Community Development Services is working on an effort with a Google program, not a computer program, but like an effort where we will be working with small businesses in the community to get them on the map. So if you use Google Maps, if you have a smartphone, if you have a computer, you probably use Google Maps to look for your where you can get your haircut, where you can buy a sandwich, where you can stop for gas, where you can do other various things. And particularly when you're not in your own community, it is the biggest resource on places to go. That and other mapping software similar to it, although Google Maps is one of the most frequently used. This is a great program that Google has put together. Makes it pretty easy for us to do this, and we're partnering with the Chamber of Commerce. They're providing some help, and we will be hosting some sessions at the library where staff will be volunteering to help people get their businesses on the map and to help them ensure that their businesses are accurately represented. So we hope to see a lot more dots when you look on Google Maps, and it's amazing. You can look up something like barbershop in Blaine, and Mr. Lawrence, we don't have any. it's a tough thing for small businesses to spend the time to do all these different things and to learn about all these different things. And the software pulls businesses and drags information onto the map, but it's not always accurate. It doesn't represent everyone, and it's not always the best image of the business because, for instance, the front of your business is going to be the Google Street scene map or picture that they snapped as they drove down the street. It's probably not the best image of the front of your building. So this will be, I think, a great effort. We'll be doing it at the end of March, and then we're going to be doing it again around mid-April, having a couple of meetings, a morning meeting and an afternoon meeting to help people both times. So we'll catch people who can't come in the morning or can't come in the afternoon. And it's pretty easy once you learn how to do it. You just need to know you have to do it.
Are you going to just show them how to do it, or are you going to walk them through it and actually do it?
We're going to show them how to do it. We're going to have volunteers there to help them do it. We are not. There's a couple reasons why we won't be doing it for people, like just saying this business needs to be on the map and going and doing it without their permission. One is,
well,
it's
no,
not our place to
that.
Do that,
no.
But also they need to know how to do it because they need to update it and be able to keep current. If their hours change, change their hours. If their services change, change their services. If they get new pictures, change their pictures. We also want to encourage people to be rating each other, so we'll try and get the local business people within the community to rate each other. If you can give someone a good rating, great, because one of the other things that people do besides look for things on software like Google Maps is to look for ratings on Yelp and Urban Spoon and places like that. And if you use those softwares, you know, if you see a restaurant that has one stars or one that has four stars, you're probably going to go to the one with four stars. And that only happens because people rate them and because their food's good.
Is the port doing something similar with their...
The port?
The port, yeah.
No. You mean it from like an economic development perspective?
No. Just to indicate what businesses they have down there.
Well, those are in the city of Blaine, so those businesses would be, they would be part of the program if they wish to be. So, yeah, it wouldn't be separate specific for the port. And so you'll start to see that, and there'll be some news releases and whatnot, and that's us, and it'll be happening in March. Great.
That's terrific.
That's it. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Michael. Okay, public safety. Chief. While you were probably working very hard, the letter from Matthew Lang was asked if some response has been made to that.
We're in the process of, prior to contacting Mr. Link, I'm doing an audit of our current complainants about the stop signs to find out if we actually still continue to have a problem down there. We do traffic enforcement, traffic education, based primarily on citizen complaints, collision and near collision data. Our complainants in this particular case, in this stop sign, are U.S. Customs Service, the owners of the property there, and the businesses across the street. We had begun doing enforcement when they changed it from a yield to a stop sign sometime back because cars weren't obeying the stop sign and causing near collisions with the semis. We have, not constant enforcement there. It's sporadic, catch-as-catch-can, and it's only done during specific reimbursed enforcement periods. And this is the first complaint we've received about it. But that doesn't mean that times haven't changed and we're actually responding to a problem that's no longer a problem. So I want to do complete due diligence to the gentleman's concerns and make sure that we make the right decision at the end. So there, it is a stop sign within our jurisdiction. However, there are other stop signs of more concern to more people that we get much more frequent complaints about than that one. So, and to that extent, but we always pay attention to these closely because sometimes they point us in a direction that we've forgotten to go.
Yes, Dennis.
Mike, did you say that there used to be, instead of a stop sign, there was a yield sign?
Correct. Years ago, there was.
And the reason it changed to a stop sign was because of the problem with?
Near collisions, and both with cars. Cars come out of the passenger car area and go to turn onto the truck route, and they don't look to the right, and they almost collide with the semis that are coming out of the semi-exit area. The second problem is the all of the businesses on the east side, which are in our city limits, the brokerage firms, the duty-free houses, they're all very paperwork-intensive, and they do a lot of that work on foot, running back and forth between the ports, both the inspectors and the employees and the drivers themselves. And they were have a problem of almost getting nicked by the cars coming out. So they couldn't The yield sign wasn't working effectively on getting people to slow down enough, so they made it a stop sign and put accoutrements to help make it more definitive. They were still having some problems, and that's when they asked for assistance, and it is inside the city limits. Frankly, talking to the officers, when they're monitoring that intersection, when they're monitoring those signs, if the people at least slow down and pay some credence, they pay homage to the sign, whether or not they actually stop, the officers treat that arterial stop sign differently than they treat a stop sign downtown. They grant them much more leeway. You pretty much have to just flat blow that sign before you're going to be talking to an officer there. So, GSA is also a component in our conversation because it is on the edge of a federal property. It's GSA, the federal government, which actually owns the signs as opposed to WashDOT. It is on a public right-of-way. There's an agreement between GSA and WashDOT as to how they fund these things, but we want to make sure that they're doing everything they can in terms of traffic calming and other appropriate means to get folks to pay attention without the possibility of enforcement. And enforcement is a tool, but it is not a solution to anything.
So if you went back to the business of a yield sign, I guess that's the question. Is that worse than having the stop sign?
My sense is, we go back to having yield signs, we have a higher risk and probably more frequent collisions, near collisions, and car peds in that area.
Okay. Who would make that decision? That's on the federal government property.
It's actually on state right-of-way within the city limits on the edge of a federal property. And it took us quite a while. When they first came out and said, we need your help enforcing this, I tried like heck to find out that was outside the city limits, to be honest with you.
State right-of-way.
Similar to when we arrest for violations at the ports of entry, it's Interstate 5 that goes through there.
Do the officers give a fair amount of warnings? It seemed to me that would get people's attention if they warned people, stopped them, and said, "I'm not going to write you a ticket, but you need to know," because a lot of these people are repeats, you know, that come across repeatedly. And if they're stopped once and given a warning, hopefully that would be enough to cause them to stop in the future. So I'm hoping that the officers give a fair amount of warnings, as you know, more so than tickets, actually.
My sense is that they do, because we give more warnings than we write actual tickets when you look at our data. But for that intersection, I can't answer specifically without going back and researching. That's a really good point, Bonnie. I'll follow up on that.
Yeah, and I'd like to see, because, I mean, it is the entrance to the country and to our city, and if we're overly aggressive, that's not good either. Yeah. So I think we have to hit that balance.
Yeah. I appreciate that. I'll follow up on that.
Question. Gift baskets.
Welcome to Blaine.
Give a gift basket.
Please stop, and here's your gift basket. Yeah.
Briefly, a few other items. I am in complete agreement with Mr. Jones in regards to the Islamic Center. The police department has had zero complaints about parking, noise, or anything else since the folks took over the contract on that building. They've been, as far as we can tell, very good neighbors to a very nice neighborhood. So. Emergency preparedness. Just note, I had a chance to speak last week at the Semiahmoo Breakfast Club. It was a really good gathering. As always, interested folks with salient questions. We outlined our current state of emergency preparedness vis-a-vis our own departmental abilities, what the definition of an emergency is and how an emergency overwhelms those abilities, and what the process is and what systems are in place going up to the state and national level. There's a strong orientation towards personal preparedness that I have not done as strong a job as I think I could do and should be done in terms of getting word out to the community in some of those areas. And we've been working at correcting that for the last few months. We're building personal preparedness into our block watch programs now, so that John Landis, one of the officers, goes out to give a block watch presentation, he introduces that concept, and there's some very good resource materials to help people walk through a process and getting themselves prepared for not just earthquake or tsunami, but natural hazards in general, without a lot of extra cost and maintenance, just simple things they can do to keep that in their mind. So we went through that process a little bit. We are participating in Cascadia Rising, which I think I've mentioned before, in the middle of the first week of June. There are going to be a couple of days where we're going to test out procedures region-wide. I've had a couple of meetings with the new emergency management director, John Gargett, who's really a guy, and our last meeting was with one of his personnel who's working on Cascadia Rising specifically, and we're now working up the plan for how the city of Blaine is going to participate. Our ACS, our police department, public works, and other departments will participate to the extent they can and identify those areas that they want to test. We're hoping that we can add a legislative component into that, and perhaps we're planning on a work session in March to spend a little time with you folks to let you know where we're at currently in terms of our procedures and our directives and what your roles will be to play in that. And if you're able, during the Cascadia Rising exercise in June, you'll have an opportunity to test that and see how it works for you, what changes you would like to make to it, to give you some more familiarity with that. More information on that as we move forward. Staffing levels, if you're around this Friday afternoon, about 2:30, 3 o'clock, Senior Officer Dan Sartain is retiring. He's had a 20-year career with us, 5 years with LA County SO prior to that, and he's going on to be a law enforcement staff person with Burlington Northern Police Department following us. He's had a very distinguished, dare I say, legendary career with our agency over the last couple months. Dan has pretty much done it all. He is a jack of all trades. He's an extremely competent professional, and we hate like heck to lose him, but we wish him the best. And if you're around Friday afternoon, have a piece of cake. Or
I'm going to be here.
Yeah. At what
time? 2:30 to 4 is, I think, when we plan to have him handcuffed to a chair.
How long has he been with us?
20 years. Just past the 20th year. He, crime scene investigator, sexual abuse investigator, homicide investigator, ran our property management unit for over a decade. It's going to take a while to fill his shoes, but so.
But I understand he's able to keep living in Blaine.
Yeah.
We think, anyway. We hope so, because he's Atlanta, too, right?
Exactly. I told him the other day, I said, the only way I'm getting through this is by, I've decided you're not going to work for someone else. You're just taking on a different assignment.
Right.
Like, he will be an integral part of our community for years to come if we're lucky. Let's see. Other staff, and Michael Munden, one of our senior officers, has taken over the assignment of property and evidence management for Dan. There's a lot of work involved in that position, and Mike is, as we speak, in the state certification academy for property management. So he's getting the training he needs on the back end of certification. He's been working with Dan for a couple of months to come up to speed on it. Jake Fair just completed his first level supervision certification process. So that was about an 11-week effort for him, and it was the first time the state had done the process almost entirely online. So he didn't have to miss any shifts to get his certification, and it worked out quite well. I was monitoring the project, and it was a very very good product that he came out with. So we were excited about that. Tim Richardson has completed his firearms instructor training. He'll be backing up Officer Andy Enorbus, who's been our weapons, firearms, and tactics instructor for a few years, helping him with those efforts. He's also going to be a TASER instructor. And outside of staff, a couple of things we're working on right now are we're prepping for our state and federal audits for the data component of our operations, because we work so closely with the federal government, because we run all sorts of there's a lot of data that we pass and have to maintain at both the state and federal levels, and we have to undergo on-scene audits for those processes. And so Amy and Lisa are preparing for those now. It'll be in the next couple of months. And my sense is, with their expertise and with the help of Bob Kreider from IT, who has been instrumental in making sure that our electronic processes are nailed down in terms of data and in our car systems, that we'll do well on those. I'll report back. Body cameras. Our body camera implementation program will proceed. It's not turned on. That is a sample of one of the devices. It's basically a camera and a memory unit and a transfer system, and there are accessories that attach to it, most predominantly of which is a small wired extension camera slash infrared system. And one of the primary reasons we went with this device is that it is the same manufacturer that makes our in-car data system, and it melds very well with the existing back-end infrastructure we have for maintaining that data, for logging it, cataloging it, indexing it, and making it available through public disclosure and for court processes. If you install body cams separate from your in-car system and you end up having to maintain these two systems, it's very labor intensive. So they have a very good front end, a very good back end. I'm in the process of testing them out, field testing them now, to make sure that I know how to answer all the questions the officers have and that we start off on the right foot. You can watch hours of video of me working on patrol cars and doing things that I did not realize the camera was running, because I had it on the wrong setting. We're getting those kinks worked out before.
So that's
we
all Bluetooth.
These use Wi-Fi.
That's in the car.
Yep. There's a dock in the patrol car, so the officer can pull it off of his vest or out of his shirt pocket. You can carry it out front like I have it tonight, or you can put it in a pouch and use the auxiliary system. But all you have to do is take it out and you put it in this little dock, and it automatically uploads it into your car's hard drive system. And from there, it gets uploaded from the car into the office when the patrol car pulls in.
How far officer away doesn't, can you get?
He doesn't, I'm sorry?
How far away can you get?
Within about a half block or so. So when the officer pulls in to do paperwork and or check something at the office, the car just realizes where it is and does the transfer in the background. We try to make it as dead simple as we could, so it would be used as much as possible without being an impact on officer time or support time. So, more news on that as it rolls out. And finally, ACS. I mentioned last week at our last meeting, ACS is working our auxiliary volunteers are, they have a very strong program for the rest of the year. They've got a lot of things that they want to accomplish, but here just in the next couple of months, this weekend we have the recertification for those members who have not had, there's an ACES class and an ACES academy they go through. And every 3 years is a recommendation to recert for that. So this weekend we're going to be taking over the council chambers to recert those who haven't had it in 3 years, a few new people, and also invited some folks in from other ACS teams around, because good networking and ups the playing field for all of us. They have their communications academy, the statewide academy, comes up in a couple of months, and we always send a team to it, both for the instruction over a couple of days and also to show off. Blaine's ACS team is one of the best ones in the state, and it gives us a chance to show off the tools and programs that they've developed and share and network and get new information. They will also be a strong component in the Cascadia Rising event. They're working with the Department of Emergency Management at the county level to make sure that we have the tools in place that we need. Any questions I can answer for anyone?
Thank you, Chief, very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Sherry, Administrative Services. Did I miss anybody? No. There we go. Administrative Services.
Thank you. Just a reminder of the Jurassic Parliament training that is being held in Ferndale. And you should have received with your agenda packets a flyer on this. That is Wednesday, March 23rd at 8:45 at the newly remodeled Pavilion, Pioneer Pavilion in Ferndale. And what I'd like to do is they need to know by March 11th, which will be before our next council meeting. So if you want, I can call or email each of you individually, or you can email me and let me know if you can attend so I can give them a head count.
I will be attending.
You will be. Okay. Anybody else know at this point?
I have trouble with tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone is interested, call Sherry and let her know that you want to attend.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. City Manager.
Mayor and Council, I'll have a very brief report. Besides the small cities meeting last Tuesday that the mayor reported on, the Port of Bellingham did approve $20,000 to go toward our needs assessment. That needs assessment RFP has been completed. We've got three responses that we're going to be taking a look at and setting up interviews for, and so we're excited about moving that project forward. We also have a request for proposal out for brokerage services for the old airport, Gateway property. We're getting phone calls, and I've already got responses in. So that closes this Friday, and we'll be coming back to the council in March for approval for those services. So that's two big projects I think that are in progress now. And then I just wanted to thank the council members who were able to attend the pavilion opening on Thursday afternoon. I think it went well and spoke to the needs of that facility for the community. As you can see from staff reports, everyone's busy and fully engaged in their jobs and trying to figure out what our next steps are moving forward. So any questions or comments or direction? Great, thank you.
I think we're good. Thank you, David. Any changes on the calendars we've got here?
I think they're good for now.
Okay. And we have an executive session, I believe.
So I put this on the calendar in case Cara was going to be here tonight. Okay. She's not, so we don't need to use it.
Okay, so no executive session.
A couple things here.
Any unfinished business or new business?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I left Michael a message about what Kelly Center said the school is going to demolish their, or get rid of whoever's doing the new high school, of the greenhouse. The school greenhouse is going to be up for anybody that wants it. And I don't know if there's any place in our world for something like that. It's just something to think about, I guess. So I don't know.
You could sell it to Seahawk.
Yeah, I don't know. A grow up, I'm sure. Whatever.
How big is it?
I was thinking about it for something.
How big
else,
is it, Charles?
Oh, it's 40, at least it's 40 feet. It's Lexan. It's not glass.
I was just thinking, if it was small enough, we could move it onto our sort of area.
They were talking about doing the street right of ways, like where the Lutheran church is along that. You know, to put it on city property. But then, you know, there's all the issues about managing it and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. Anyway, they're just going to destroy it. So
they aren't going to have a replacement?
Yeah, it's going to be a $100,000 replacement, a better one.
Okay, so they don't imagine the city has any.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I brought it up. Yeah, I know.
You don't want to grow flowers in there?
I do not want to do that.
Sounds
great.
Don't go there. I made a promise that I would bring
okay.
it up.
Okay, leave it alone. Any other?
I have one more question.
Yes, go ahead.
Guys walking around the beach, Drayton Harbor, on Saturday. You know, looking like they were checking out anything you know about for kayak sites or ramps or beach or anything.
Sorry, I...
There was guys walking around the inside of the beach, around in front of our house, along towards the park and stuff like that. It looked like they were taking samples, checking out the drainage. The next thing I knew, there's about 10 kayakers come with high water came back around through there. So I was wondering if there's something going on.
I'll look into that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I just...
Yeah, it's not part of our stormwater
or our
shoreline update. It wasn't us doing a survey for a kayak launch or
stairs to the beach. You know, a little bit of water, you know, mud was showing. And then when high water came around, there was about 10 kayakers came around and went along the shore. So I don't know.
Michael, as you go around Semiahmoo, there seems to be a lot of activity there. I noticed there was another lot being cleared.
In the uplands,
There
continues to be a few building permits.
Yeah, I think it's looks good. I mean, look, we should have quite a few homes going in this year.
I hope so. I mean, there's a good possibility that on this side of the city, we may be getting a 15-unit condominium building. So it looks like numbers could be up substantially, but it's only February, so it's not making any promises.
But I think there looks to be activity, so I think it's good. I think we're starting to see it turn the corner when it comes to new construction.
I think so.
Yeah, good. Okay, Bonnie, you have some.
I have one thing.
One question.
A school board member reminded me when we were talking about the school, asked if the city might consider doing a land swap. Apparently, the Boys and Girls Club parking lot and the outside basketball court is owned by school, not by the city.
Right.
And the school board member said, would we entertain either purchasing the parking lot, that whole area, from them, or doing a land swap of some sort? Apparently they can use more space for buses. And he even asked about the hangar. You know, they could use something, a building, I said I would bring it up and see if that was something that was feasible for us. Because my thought is, related to that, is where the basketball courts are, and maybe it would require a little more space than that to bring the skate park to that location. Put it where the kids are, right by the Boys and Girls Club. Hopefully we wouldn't have to take any of the parking, but we might have to take one row, I don't know, space-wise. But all those elements in the skate park are movable, removable, so we could bring them to a different location. But I just think it would make sense to have the skate park
right
by where
parking,
the kids are.
All the parking.
But we'd lose maybe some of the parking, not all of it, but some of it.
But then they'd lose the outdoor basketball courts, too.
Well, I don't know they need them if they have the indoor courts now, so I don't know, but in any case, whether we do that or not, so could you look into that?
Ron Spanger and I have been talking about some of those options, and he's mentioned to me at least half a dozen times in the last 2 years that they want to do something about it. It just sits on the books. They've got to pay insurance for it, and the insurance carrier are asking, why do you have this land, and what's the purpose, and it's becoming kind of a
can't they donate
a problem? Sure. But just like you donate to them, they have to find public benefit.
Exactly.
In that.
Well, there is a public
very
benefit.
It's hard for them to find a public benefit.
There is a public benefit.
Right, there is, but it doesn't serve them necessarily.
Sell it for a dollar, you know.
But they're they're wonderful to work with. And so I'll talk to them and see what they need. We had a conversation earlier today about the airport hangar facility, and one of the questions that's coming up from some of the guys and gals that are working on the request for proposal for the airport site is, what about the hangar? What's your plan with the hangar? Mm-hmm. So we spent just a few minutes this morning talking about what those options are. So that building is desirable for certain kinds of uses. It's also a very important building for the ACS program that you just heard the police chief talk about.
Yeah,
they use that building for their meeting space, their training space. Mm-hmm. They have their mobile unit that they have worked on and their pride and joy of their fleet that sits inside the building fully plugged in and charged. So, you know, one of these things, you pull a plug here, you cause a problem there. So we have to be pretty thoughtful.
I think the best option is to get, convince them to donate it to the city.
Well, you know, they're policymakers, just like the city council.
It serves
and so citizens the city. Can go to the park board just as easily as they can come here and put some plugs in people's
pressure.
Ears and
yeah.
have that conversation.
But I'll talk to them, offer them a dollar.
Huh?
I think we could offer them at least a dollar.
You know, yeah. All that board has to do is agree to the findings that it's in the public's interest to do that. But okay. I think they got an appraisal back at about 150.
Okay.
So it's going to be a large rate between 150 and 1. But you're an optimist. I'm
but
going
they
for
can't
it.
Sell it to anybody else. I mean,
oh, yes, they can.
Yeah.
Well, sure, they can. That's not
yeah,
our
but,
property. It'd be a public outcry.
I don't think they would. Let me put it
that
way.
Pretty nasty.
Yes.
They could move the greenhouse over
definitely.
There.
Definitely.
They moved the greenhouse over there.
You've been great tonight. I knew it was going to come.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know a lot of people that would use that.
Actually, the greenhouse would be a wonderful resource for the senior center.
Yeah. Yep.
It would be a wonderful.
We could still put it in that street right away.
There you go.
It's close.
That's the next project. Move the greenhouse.
Okay,
if there's no further business, I'm going to bring the meeting to a close at 7:53.
Good.